Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. When you travel to an equatorial region, particularly if you will be staying in a developing country, the CDC recommends immunizations for everything from yellow fever to typhoid to rabies. But did you know you could get a tropical disease without leaving Texas? One in particular, known as Chagas disease, has been mostly associated with Latin America and may not be familiar to U.S. doctors. But the insect that spreads it lives here, and health experts are beginning to realize that thousands of Texans might already be infected and susceptible to life-threatening heart disease decades after that first bite. Dr. Seema Yasmin is professor of public health at the University of Texas at Dallas and staff writer at the Dallas Morning News. Her interactive series on Chagas and other tropical diseases in Texas is online now at dallasnews.com. Seema, welcome back to Think.
Thanks for having me again.
All right, before we get to Chagas specifically, we're looking at a whole category here of what are called neglected tropical diseases. What does that mean?
So these are a group of infections, about 40 different diseases, in fact, that affect people mostly in tropical and subtropical parts of the world, here in the U.S. as well, though. And really the neglected part is really crucial. We think about 1.5 billion people on the planet are infected with one or more of this group of diseases, but they're neglected because largely governments and drug companies don't really care about the poor people that are impacted. And it really is primarily a disease of people living in poverty. And the reason that this first struck me as really interesting is, as a reporter, I'm always looking in medical journals for story ideas. And so a couple of years ago, I was reading about neglected tropical diseases. And in this one journal, they had a list of 10 hotspots. And they had Brazil and Honduras and all these different countries. And then they had Texas on the list.
And you thought, like, wait, what? Yeah, and so why is Texas a new hotspot for these?
So it may not be a new hotspot, and that's the really interesting thing. Some of the experts I've spoken to have said, look, we've had traces of these diseases for maybe hundreds, maybe even thousands of years. They've been here. They've been sickening people. But what we're seeing now is perhaps a perfect storm of conditions that may be either peaking these conditions or we're just getting better at looking for them. And that perfect storm is a lot to do with climate change and rising temperatures, but also poverty. So that's a really big problem in Texas right now. We have probably more people living in poverty than any other state in the U.S. About 1 in 5 people in the U.S., in Texas, is living in poverty, and it's even higher for kids, more than 1 in 4 kids. And that really is one of the biggest risk factors for infection with one of these diseases.
So why would poverty be a risk factor for infection? Is it about substandard housing?
Definitely housing is a really important part of it. So you think about how some of these diseases are spread. Let's look at Chagas disease. You get Chagas disease when you get bitten by a bug called the kissing bug. Looks a bit like a beetle, but kind of more interesting. It has these funny markings on it. And if you live in a house that has intact windows, I mean, something as basic as windows and screens, and you perhaps spray insecticide around and your yard doesn't have junk in it, then you're much less likely to have these bugs around and to get bitten. It's not foolproof. These can occur everywhere. But we do think that when people, especially kids, are living in housing that's dilapidated, where the windows are broken, they don't have screens, they don't have air conditioning, they're just much, much more at risk of infection, of getting bitten and then becoming infected with these diseases.
So what is Chagas disease?
So Chagas disease is caused by a parasite called T. cruzi. When you look at it under a microscope, it almost looks like a little wriggly worm. And it is spread by the kissing bug. But the interesting thing about this parasite is somebody can have it. And, you know, the first time they get bitten, they may have some flu-like symptoms, maybe nothing that noticeable. And then for decades, maybe even 30 years, they could have no symptoms at all. No symptoms at all for that long, even though the parasite is swimming around in them. And that's because it likes to bury in the heart muscle, it likes to bury in the gut. But what can happen after 2, maybe 3 decades is people can start to get heart symptoms, they can get short of breath, chest pain, start to feel really weak and dizzy, or they can get symptoms in their nerves and in their gut. And it can cause heart failure and sudden death in 1/3 of people who are infected. So it's a really, really serious disease, but you could be walking around as a Texan and not know that you have it.
Sometimes people who seem healthy get heart disease. Is it possible that some of those cases that we haven't been able to explain could have been linked to Chagas disease?
Absolutely. And that's what the experts at the National School of Tropical Medicine in Houston said to me. They said, look, people get to their mid-40s, their mid-50s, and they get symptoms of heart disease. And the doctor says, this is what happens when you age. And the doctors aren't realizing that these diseases like Chagas are here and that they need to be testing for those too. And that could potentially be a reversible cause of heart disease if you catch it early enough. And so they're frustrated that physicians in the US, especially in hotspots like Texas, aren't realizing that this disease is here and that they should be looking for it.
So you open the piece with the story of a woman who found out she had Chagas disease. She has no symptoms, but she went to donate blood, as a lot of people do, and had a test.
Candice went to donate blood a couple of years ago. She's 51 years old now. She lives in LaGrange, Texas, a really incredible woman. And in fact, she went to donate blood because her own mother had leukemia and was relying on lots and lots of blood donations. So she went to donate blood and she filled out the questionnaire that you have to fill out before you can donate. And one of the questions was, have you donated blood? And she kind of was thinking, I'm sure I have, but it was ages ago. And did I really? Like, I can't remember. And so she checked the box for no. And the blood center tested her for a bunch of things. And every time you go and donate blood, you will get tested for HIV, hep C. There's a list of viruses and bacteria that they will test for. But they also will test for Chagas disease only on the first time that you go to donate. So because they thought she hadn't donated, they tested her. She went home and a few weeks later got this letter in the mail that actually her mum opened, and her mum was really confused by it, gave it to Candice, and it said, you've tested positive for Chagas disease. Thanks, but no thanks. We don't want your blood. And she freaked out. She hadn't heard of it, didn't know how to pronounce this. She put it into Google and was really alarmed by what came up.
And there is no way of knowing when she acquired the infection.
She was trying to guess because she found a kissing bug afterwards in the home that she was staying in, LaGrange, this gorgeous oak home. It was beautiful. It wasn't, you know, one of the houses I was describing earlier, right? So it just shows this can happen anywhere. But yeah, it's hard to know. She wasn't sure when she was bitten. She's not sure when she was infected. But the truth is that she hadn't left Texas in at least 20 years. Hmm. So it was here.
So she checked, no, she hadn't donated before, just to make sure she was being careful. She was tested. If she hadn't been tested, she still wouldn't know.
She still would not know. And the really worrying thing is, with this investigation that we did with the Dallas Morning News and Eva Parks and Scott Friedman at NBC5, is we found a really terrible, really fatal flaw in the blood testing system, which is that if Candice had many years ago gone to donate blood and had had a negative Chagas test because she didn't have the disease then, and then she had gone a couple of years later to donate blood, they would have said, oh, she's already had one negative test for Chagas. We don't need to test her again. And she would have been free to donate blood over and over and over.
Without knowingly doing anything wrong, she wouldn't have had any idea.
She would not have known. And why would she know? She doesn't have any symptoms.
Is this an expensive test compared to testing for things like HIV and hep C?
Not necessarily. It's a newer test. And of course, the experts in blood safety said that those kinds of tests pay for themselves, because one of them especially was really, really concerned about the fact that Americans are at risk for Chagas disease, because he said the blood system is not safe. In fact, the words, and this keeps ringing in my head, he said, Americans are sitting ducks waiting for an epidemic to happen. Mm-hmm. Because we're not testing every time. And so somebody like Candice could go without symptoms, have had one negative test, and then it's free to donate blood. And in that way, the whole blood system becomes contaminated.
Now, I can understand that blood donation centers, you know, they want to bring people in time and time again, and they don't want to make the question portion too onerous, or else people say, it just wastes too much of my time. But it would seem as if donating blood and then sending it off to a lab somewhere, that doesn't affect the person who is donating, right?
From the perspective of the blood centers, and we talked to people at the Carter Blood Center in Austin, they said, look, there haven't been that many infections from transfusions. And all of the science from the FDA and the guidelines point to the fact that a one-off test is okay. So that's their perspective. They're saying, look, it works okay. We don't want to put people off donating blood because it's so crucial. We need more donors. We don't want people to turn away because, like you said, the questionnaire is onerous. But the flip side of that is that, well, maybe maybe there are lots of people who have become infected from transfusions and we just don't know it yet because they either haven't been diagnosed or we haven't put two and two together and realized that's how they became infected.
All right. So Candace found out that she had the infection, Googled it, freaked out, went looking for a doctor and didn't have a great experience, at least initially.
She had a terrible experience, the kind of experience that I, as a physician myself, just makes me really, really sad. So one of the first things she did after she Googled and found a creepy video of the parasite and really alarming facts was she called the CDC. She called the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, told them who she was and where she was, and they said, find an infectious disease doctor. And so she's a really proactive, you know, well-educated woman. She found an infectious disease doctor, went to see them very soon afterwards, just a matter of days, and the doctor said, haven't really treated anyone with this disease. I don't know much about it. Find somebody else.
Wow.
So then she does. She takes the advice and finds another infectious disease doctor. And the doctor just isn't that great. The doctor is looking through notes and reading through books and journals, not giving her clear answers. It wasn't just that Candace wanted reassurance. She just wanted answers to her questions. And she wasn't getting them from doctors. And in the end, what she told me, and I found this just so incredible, was she looked for answers. And the two people that she found that sat her down and just answered everything, gave her all the information, they weren't physicians. They were veterinarians.
Because this is a commonly known infection in animals.
It is. It's more commonly known about among vets than it is among MDs. But this is a hot topic for me, I think, because 3 out of every 5 new diseases in us, in humans, comes from animals. So we need to be aware of what's going on among the animal population in Texas as much as we do about diseases in humans in Texas, for example. And at Texas A&M, there's an amazing vet called Dr. Sarah Hamer, who heads up a big lab on Chagas disease. And she did a study a year or so ago, which found that almost 10% of shelter dogs, and shelter dogs is an example representing other dogs in Texas, but about 10% of those dogs were positive for Chagas disease. So it's in dogs, and those bugs will bite them, and then they also will bite us. So we know that this parasite is circulating in Texas, and there needs to be better communication between physicians and veterinarians.
So if somebody knows that they are infected or their pet is infected, what is the standard treatment?
The treatment, while there are 2 treatments and neither of them are approved by the FDA, they're investigational drugs that you can only get via the CDC. So first you have to find a doctor who knows what they're doing, which it took Candace a couple of tries and, you know, even then. And then that doctor has to run tests on you. The CDC will ask for an additional test. And then you get your hands on one of these 2 anti-parasitic medicines. And they're not fantastic, but if you take them very early on, they can be between 60 to 85% effective. Of course, you may not take it very early on because it may be a long time before you have symptoms. Or even if you do get bitten, you may come up with what Candace came up with, which is a doctor who doesn't really know what they're doing. Mm. And, you know, we saw this in Houston a couple of years ago when we started screening blood donors here for Chagas disease. A bunch of folks in Houston suddenly got the same letters that Candace got. I think this is in 2007, saying, you have this disease called Chagas, you can't donate blood. So they did what they were told to do. These folks in Houston took the letter to their doctor. And guess what their doctor said? Oh, we don't have that disease in the U.S. That must be a mistake.
Wow. So they didn't receive treatment at all.
I'm sure some of them did not based on that, but they're being followed up by the experts at the National School of Tropical Medicine in Houston. But that's really alarming that a physician, the one who's supposed to help you, might be the one who tells you, no, it's a mistake. That's not here. It is here.
We're speaking this hour with Dr. Seema Yasmin, public health professor at the University of Texas at Dallas and staff writer at the Dallas Morning News. Her interactive series on tropical diseases in Texas is online now at dallasnews.com. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for spring 2016 to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, specializing in human rights, organizational dynamics, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
Well, we've been trying to get some numbers and working with the Center for Disease Control, and we think now there's actually 12 million Americans living with a neglected tropical disease in the United States. And we think that Texas and also some adjoining areas of the Gulf Coast are kind of ground zero for the neglected tropical disease problem. And they're ground zero because of the confluence of two major factors. One, poverty. Texas has the largest numbers of people living in poverty of any state in the United States. And second, we're just still a component of climate. Warm and subtropical climate also contribute. So we kind of get the perfect storm of that here in Texas.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. You just heard the voice of Dr. Peter Hotez, who is Dean of the Baylor University National School of Tropical Medicine in Houston, featured in my guest's reporting on neglected tropical diseases in Texas. Dr. Seema Yasmin is here today. She's public health professor at the University of Texas at Dallas, also staff writer at the Dallas Morning News. If you would like to join our conversation, you can email think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Skip, who wants to know, when you say that Texas is a hot spot for these diseases, are you talking numbers of people who have them or the percentage of Texans?
It's probably the number of people that have them. So those experts at the National School of Tropical Medicine, Dr. Peter Hotez, who we just heard from, they estimate that about 300,000 Americans in the Americans have Chagas disease, but they think the majority of those are in Texas. So it's probably more about just the overall number of people living with diseases like Chagas.
There are also effects on the gut, and you mentioned that earlier, that that's another place that this little parasitic worm can reside.
Yeah, so about one in three people who are infected with a parasite will go on to develop heart failure that can be deadly. It can just cause sudden death. And about one in 10 will suffer disease to the nerves and to the gut that can start with things like food getting stuck in the throat. So really the gut starts to slow down. And then also further down the gut, food starts to get stuck so that people become extremely constipated. They have very terrible stomach cramps and just the overall digestive tract stops working.
This again sounds like the sort of thing that you might visit your doctor for and have a battery of tests, and maybe nobody thinks to do a test for Chagas disease.
That's the worrying thing. And that's why in Houston, these experts are running these 8-week long programs on diseases like Chagas and other tropical diseases too. And they love the fact that physicians who have an interest in the topic will take their course and will realize that, oh, a patient can have stomach ache and it could be something that I think of already, but it could be one of these diseases that actually is right here. But their other concern is that for the vast majority of physicians, I mean, myself included, you get such little training on this in med school and then in during residency. I remember thinking when I was learning about parasites in med school, it wasn't very long at all, and it was so fascinating. And I remember thinking, wow, billions of people on the planet are infected with parasites. And we really don't spend a lot of time learning about it, primarily because you think, I'm going to work in the UK or I'm going to work in the US. I probably won't see those infections. And that's really not true.
Is that essentially, did your professor say to you at the time, we don't have these in the UK, this is just a little side note and it won't be on the quiz? Is that kind of how they approach it?
I mean, it's definitely in the quiz. You have to know your parasitology. But the idea is that, yep, you're going to work in London and you might see it in travelers returning from exotic parts of the world. But in your day-to-day patients, you probably won't see these infections. And we can't say that's true anymore for physicians, especially in places like Texas.
So should we ask our doctors for a screen?
Yeah, I think you should. I think especially if you have symptoms, for sure. If you found one of these kissing bugs in your home, then the best thing to do is don't touch it with bare hands, but use gloves or a plastic bag, bag it up, and then go to the Texas A&M website, and you can send the bug into the lab there, and they will do tests on it to find out whether it contains Chagas, whether it contains human blood. In fact, what they found is really disturbing. They've been doing this kind of like citizen science project.
Oh, I knew we were getting to this, yeah.
It probably will start making you scratch a little bit, but it's okay. They've been doing this really cool citizen science project where they ask Texans from all over the state, if you find one of these bugs, send it in. And lo and behold, they've been getting kissing bugs sent in from all over Texas. And when they've been testing them in the lab, they find that about between 60 and 70% of them are positive for the parasite, and about the same proportion are positive for human blood. In fact, if the person who sends it in said, I found this inside my house, as opposed to I found it in the garden, then the ones found inside our homes 100% of the time they tested positive for human blood. So they're biting us. The majority of them have the parasite. So if you find them, send them in. And then for sure, go to your doctor. And I'm sorry to say, you might come up against a doctor who doesn't know much about this. But like Candace did, you have to just keep on going until you find someone that can offer some answers.
Should we assume that everyone who is bitten has been bitten by a kissing bug that tests positive for this parasite will get Chagas disease?
Not necessarily, because there's about 30 to 40% of them who are not positive so far that we know of for the parasite. So hopefully if you do find one and you have been bitten, it doesn't have the parasite. So it's not a guarantee, but it's good to know, because with those investigational drugs that I mentioned earlier, some of them, they're quite toxic, they're not perfect, but they work better the sooner you take them. Which is why Candace was so anxious when she went from one doctor and got bounced to another. She wasn't sure when she'd been bitten, but she did know from her own research, not from what the doctors had said. She knew that the sooner she took the meds, the better. And sadly, gosh, it was so frustrating. It ended up being a 6-month wait before she ever got those tablets.
Are pregnant women tested for this?
Not as far as I know, and they really should be, because it can be passed on from mother to baby during pregnancy. It's another way that it's transmitted.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Chelsea in Grapevine. Hi, Chelsea.
Hi. Yes, I have a question. I heard that you said that the Chagas disease is rooted in the parasite that can get in your gut, and I'm wondering, could you focus on a diet that would be detoxing, anti-parasitical, one in which the actual parasite wouldn't want to stay there, or you could find a way to kind of maybe eat certain foods that would encourage the parasite not to stay or not to stick?
From everything that I've read, I have not seen anything that says that diet can actually help with this. It's those antiparasitic medicines that seem to do the trick. And they work best early on when the parasite's really swimming around in the blood, because what can happen over time is a parasite starts to bury into heart muscle and bury into the gut, and it really hides there and hides out for decades before causing symptoms. But I haven't seen anything about specific diets that could help with this. It's really preventing the disease that's, you know, the most important thing. And then if you are bitten, getting the medicines very early on.
This is maybe the kind of weird question that only I would ask, Seema, but is it the same worm sort of living in the heart muscle or in the gut, or does this thing continually reproduce itself within your system if you're infected?
It's the same one. And yes, it will multiply for sure, and you can have very high levels of parasite in the body, but it's the same one.
Okay. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. I was very surprised to learn that we haven't been requiring doctors who do, organizations who do detect patients that have Chagas disease, to record this anywhere so that we can track the levels over time and how much they are changing.
Yeah, within public health, we have a list of diseases that varies by state. And these are diseases, as a doctor or a vet, if you diagnose them, you have to report them to public health. And that's really helpful, because you end up getting kind of like a baseline of what's out there and how big a problem is it. We only started looking for Chagas 2 years ago in 2013, both in humans and in dogs. So that's a great start. Already it's a reportable condition. But what people worry about is, just because a disease is added to that list of reportable diseases doesn't mean that doctors are calling it in every time they diagnose a case. They may not know to do it. They may not remember that it's on the list of reportable diseases. The other problem is that it's just not on doctors' radars. And that's what I kept hearing over and over again from talking to experts who said, yep, it's great, it's on the list and it should be reported. But doctors out there aren't even thinking about these infections. So if they're not even testing for it, how will we ever know it's out there?
We have an email here from Sue, who wants the spelling of the disease. It's C-H-A-G-A-S, Chagas disease, so that way she can ask about being tested. So thanks for that question, Sue. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Another question, how can we get tested for Chagas without having to donate blood, especially if our primary care physician insists it's unnecessary?
That's a tricky one, isn't it? And one of the experts, Dr. Christy Murray at Baylor, she's a veterinarian. She said, if you want to know if you've got Chagas disease, go and donate blood, because that's an automatic way of finding out. But ideally, you should be able to have that conversation with your doctor. And there is a test out there that can detect either the parasite itself or antibodies to the parasite.
What is done for animals? There's some really moving stuff. You know, there's a very moving story of a woman who has been dealing with this, but people's pets are also affected.
Yeah, and there's a gorgeous dog who's in our interactive story as well called Kiska. She's the cutest little furry white ball of a dog, and she became infected when she lived in Plano. Mm. And she had a really, really sad story. She nearly died. She kept having heart attacks over and over and over. And her owner spent probably close to like $10,000 on trying to save Kiska's life. And I'm happy to report that they're not in Plano, they're in Fairview, but she's a very happy dog that you wouldn't know that she is sick. She has a pacemaker inside her that keeps her heart beating, without which she probably would not be alive. But again, there's not that much that they could do for her. They gave her some treatments and now she has the pacemaker, and that's kind of the best that the vets could do.
To be clear, this is not a zoonotic infection to the extent no one's going to catch this from their dog.
Correct. You will not catch Chagas disease from a dog. You also will not catch it from another person unless, of course, that person donated blood and you received that blood. So for humans, it's spread when we are bitten by the kissing bug. For dogs, they catch it either when they are bitten by the bug or when they eat the insect themselves.
Any indication that it could be sexually transmitted?
We haven't seen any reports of that at all, no.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Joanne in Fort Worth. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. I'm glad you took my call. I have a question about finding the Chagas disease by accident if one is preparing for a colonoscopy. I just recently had one, so this makes me wonder. First of all, would it be detected at all by the doctor giving the colonoscopy, and also would the preparation for it in cleaning out the colon ahead of time, would that eliminate the parasite if it were there?
The cleaning out before the colonoscopy would not clear out the parasite. That's not how the treatments generally work. And the best way to find out if you are infected is to have a blood test for it. That shows that you have antibodies, that you've been exposed to the parasite. Early on in infection, say when you've very recently been bitten and there's high levels of parasite in the blood, then you can do blood tests that specifically look for the parasite itself.
Is there any kind of vaccine for people who might live in high-risk areas?
Nope. And again, that's why this is one of the diseases that falls under the neglected tropical diseases. You think about how many people are infected around the world. We think maybe upwards of 11 million people have Chagas, mainly in Latin America. And yet we have these two treatments that are investigational but aren't that great. And we don't have a vaccine for it. It's unacceptable.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Jim is on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Jim.
Hello. Yeah, I just had the question of is there sort of a tracking by area of the frequency and how many people may have contracted or been found to have this parasite within Texas, so you can know if your area potentially is a high risk or not?
That's a great question, because we know with diseases you do get kind of focal areas that have more cases than others. And the best place to get that information is from the Texas A&M website. We have some of that information, our interactive on dallasnews.com, and we got a lot of that data from the experts in Houston. What we did find is that when they were looking at Texan blood donors who tested positive for Chagas, they found that about one in every 6,500 Texans who donate blood have Chagas disease or have the parasite that causes Chagas disease. They identified those people from 100 different zip codes in Texas, and they really were all over the state. We think that rates might be higher in the south because it's warmer, but really we're seeing this in cute little dogs that run around in downtown Dallas. We're seeing this in people who are living in Plano and LaGrange, so it's all over the state.
Could a spike in animal cases predict a spike in human cases?
Yes, and that's why it's really important to keep an eye on the animal side of things as well. And, you know, I write in the story about Dr. Christy Murray in Baylor, who goes out and gives talks, educational talks about Chagas disease. And she gave a talk to a room of 200 vets. And at the beginning, she said, hands up if you've diagnosed a case of Chagas. And the vets, 200 of them put their hands up. And then a couple of weeks later, she gave the same talk to a group of MDs, and like a couple of hands went up.
Wow.
But really, the MDs need to be aware of what's going on in terms of animal health, because even though the disease isn't spread from directly from dogs to humans, it's an indicator that if dogs are becoming infected, humans are at risk too. The infection is out there. The bug that spreads it is out there.
So I take your point completely that you find it unacceptable that, you know, people are going to ask their doctors about this. Doctors are saying, I don't know what this is, or this is not important. On the other hand, can you talk a little bit about the about what physicians do to keep themselves informed when there is so much new information coming all the time? And there's a challenge, I would imagine, for a, you know, a general practice physician to keep up with every trend. How is this kind of information passed within the medical community?
That's a great question. And it is challenging to keep up, but then it's one of the reasons why you choose medicine as a profession is because it's always changing and developing, and it's exciting to try and keep up with all the new developments. So there's the course in Baylor in Houston that's offered. Of course, not everyone can commit to 8 weeks of training, but then there are great modules online. The CDC has educational materials, and it's really on you as a physician to be aware of where you are, where you practice, the epidemiology of where you practice, and to know that there are these infections are out there and that you have to stay on top of them. So sure, there's a lot going on in medicine. I totally get that. But this is an important issue here. And we think that there are maybe hundreds of thousands of people who are unaware that they have Chagas disease and really deserve to have that diagnosed and hopefully treated.
Back to the phones now. This time we have Devin on the line in Weatherford. Hi, Devin.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Well, I actually have backyard chickens and pigs and ducks. And yesterday I found a whole little kind of nest of these bugs hiding. And it was, honestly, I squished them before I went inside and researched and realized that I should have tried to collect them and send them in. Anyways, my question was, are any of my other animals at risk for Chagas from these kissing bugs?
Thank you so much, Devin. What do you know about that, Seema?
Potentially, but really what we're seeing here is infections among dogs and among humans. So I would have to defer to a vet, but all the ones I've spoken to so far have only mentioned dogs. And we're seeing this among hunting dogs. People really prize their hunting dogs, and they're finding they're falling dead from Chagas disease because they're suffering heart disease and heart attacks. And we've also seen it tragically among military working dogs. So you can read more about that in our story on DallasNews.com. But these are phenomenally trained dogs that cost about $20,000 to $30,000 to train. And because they're right here in Texas where we have these bugs and we have this parasite, they're becoming infected on military bases. And it means that they can't do the incredible work that they do, sniffing out bombs and protecting their human teammates. And so they either get retired or put down because they became infected with Chagas disease.
We're speaking this hour with Dr. Seema Yasmin, a staff writer at the Dallas Morning News and public health professor at the University of Texas at Dallas. You can read her interactive series on tropical diseases, including Chagas. It's online now at DallasNews.com. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for spring 2016 to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, a customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with public health professor Dr. Seema Yasmin of the University of Texas at Dallas and of the Dallas Morning News, where she's a staff writer. You can read her interactive series on neglected tropical diseases, including Chagas, online at DallasNews.com. We'll go back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. We have Philip on the line in Tyler. Hey, Philip.
Hi. Thanks for speaking with me. A couple of days ago, I was pretty confident was a kissing bug in my dishes. And I was confident because I saw a picture of it about a week before. And I didn't think to hold on to it and send it anywhere, so I just threw it out. The comment that was made that 100% of the bugs found in a home have blood in them, I wanted to know if they are able to confirm that that blood was the homeowner. And then the other question was, what's the time frame of treatment? How long do you have, before it's untreatable?
So let me just start off by saying that since our investigation, the lab at Texas A&M in College Station that does the testing of kissing bugs has been inundated. And so they do want us to remind people that kissing bugs are night feeders, they're nocturnal insects, and that they're most active between May and October. So hopefully we should start seeing fewer and fewer of them now, especially as it's getting so cold here because they don't like the cold. In regards to your question about whether it was homeowner's blood, that I don't know whether they look specifically to see which individual's blood was in the bug, but I do know they were looking for human blood in general. And they were finding that between 60 to 70% of the time with bugs that were found outside and 100% of the time when the bug was found inside. Now, I would assume it was the people that lived in the home, but I don't know that they were specifically looking for that. They were just looking to see if the bug had any human blood in it as an indicator that it was biting humans. As for the treatment, it's most effective when taken very early on within the first few months of infection, which is really tricky because people won't always know that they've been bitten. They may not realize that they have the disease. They may just think they have some kind of flu-like symptoms. But the pills are 60 to 85% effective if taken early on.
So there's not a 100% chance that Philip has Chagas disease. He should be tested if he's worried.
Oh, gosh, no. And also because what he saw may or may not be a kissing bug because we're seeing so many less of them now that we're in the month of November. The best thing to do when you find one of these bugs is don't touch it with bare hands. Just try and trap it either using a glove or a plastic bag and then go to Texas A&M's kissing bug website where the first thing you can do is look at the picture, compare it to what you've caught and actually see whether it's a kissing bug. It looks a lot like other beetles as well, so you want to make sure that it is what you think it is before you send it in to them.
Any recommendations with regard to insecticide? This is something people are concerned about using in their homes any more than they have to, but of course they want to be safe.
Absolutely. One of the first things you can do is, in terms of outside of the house, is moving wood piles away because these bugs, these kissing bugs, love to hide out in wood piles and under rocks and under bits of wood. And that's where the family in Plano, where their dog became infected, that's where they think these bugs were hiding out. In terms of inside the house, you won't see any products that say they are meant for kissing bugs, but the folks that I spoke to said look out for insecticides that are meant to kill roaches and that are meant for indoor use, and look for things that have permethrin in them. And we also on DallasNews.com have some information about which insecticides you could use.
All right, let's go back to the phones. How about George in Plano? Hi, George.
Oh, yes. Hi, Chris. Thank you. Doctor, I wanted to ask you if because these are tropical diseases, if it's safer to live out in the drier areas of West Texas, out where it's more like a desert type of a climate.
Not necessarily. With the Chagas disease, they've been finding the bugs all over. They've been finding people infected with the disease all over. Like I said, when they were tracking blood donors in Texas who became infected, they found people that lived across 100 different zip codes. And I should say that we focus a lot on Chagas disease, but there are other neglected tropical diseases that are right here in Texas as well. And some of them actually prefer that drier, hotter climate that you find in West Texas.
I wanted to get to some of those other diseases, but we have a lot of questions still coming in from listeners, so we'll continue to answer some of these. We have Garvin on the line in Lake Highlands. Hi, Garvin.
Hello. Chris, thanks for taking my call. Dr. Yasmin, how are you? I have two specific questions. One, is the official name of the bug, the kissing bug, if I want to look it up, see what it looks like, I could go to that website, sure, but if I want to look it up on my own, is it called the kissing bug? And the second question, is there anything notable or noteworthy about being bitten? Does it create a rash? Does it create discoloration? How would I know right at first that, that wasn't a mosquito, that's a kissing bug bite? And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Those are good questions, Garvin. Thanks.
So the science-y name for it is the triatomine bug. But, even scientists don't call it that. We call it the kissing bug. So if you Google that, you will come up with images and information specifically about the bug that carries the parasite that causes Chagas disease. And the second question?
Anything notable about the bite? And this explains actually why it's called the kissing bug, right?
Yes. Oh, so you want me to get into the really gruesome details. So the reason that it, the name is triatomine, but we call it the kissing bug, is because of where it likes to bite us. So I'm sorry to say this, but this beetle-type insect likes to bite us on the face, around the eye, and the mouth. And it isn't actually the bite that infects us.
Okay, put your lunch aside.
So yeah, it's really bad timing, isn't it? It's when, after it bites us, it poops near where it bites. And that irritation causes us to kind of rub that area, right? Because it's sore. And when we do that, we rub the feces into the bite and the parasite is in the feces. So it's that lovely combination of the kissing bug biting us and then pooping on our faces. And there is something that can happen that's really distinctive after a kissing bug bites you, especially around the eye as opposed to the mouth. And that is that one eye can become really swollen and inflamed, but that doesn't happen in the majority of people. So you may never realize you've been bitten. And Candice in LaGrange, who has Chagas disease, certainly doesn't recall being bitten by a kissing bug. But in the months after she realized what had happened and she knew to look out for them, she found a dead one inside her house.
So how often should people be tested?
That's a tricky question. I mean, I know with the blood testing system, we found this flaw and we think that it should be every single time someone goes to donate blood. But probably just starting off with one conversation with your physician is a good idea. Assessing your potential risk for the disease based on where you live, based on if you've seen any kissing bugs, based on whether you have any symptoms. That's probably a good starting point.
Are people who spend a lot of time outdoors perhaps at greater risk?
Definitely, especially hunters, we think, because they're out there, they're in wooded areas where these bugs like to live. They're up against other animals that might get bitten by these bugs. And actually, now I recall we had an earlier question about can other animals become infected. I think deer can, and they can also develop heart disease from it as well. So those bugs are definitely out there in nature, and people who like doing outdoorsy things like camping and hunting might be at higher risk.
All right, let's go through the list of some of the other things that are briefly covered in this series. Chikungunya is something that we've heard a lot about recently, or over the summer, that I hadn't heard much about at all before.
Yeah, it's been making the news because chikungunya, which some of us call chick, has been causing really big outbreaks in the Caribbean and parts of Latin America. And so, of course, even though we don't have it established here in Texas, we travel all the time. And so we're hearing more about people coming back sick with this disease. Now, chikungunya is caused by a virus. There's no specific treatment for it. And it isn't usually fatal. That's the good news. The bad news is that it hurts like heck. It's really, really painful. And in fact, the word chikungunya comes from an East African word that when it's translated means to be doubled up, as in like contorted, because the joint pain is so severe. We do, unfortunately, even though we don't have the virus here, have the mosquitoes that can spread the virus. That means all it could take to start an outbreak here is one person goes on vacation somewhere where there's lots of chikungunya. They fly back home to Texas. They get bitten by mosquitoes here while they're infected, and then those mosquitoes can go on to bite other people, and that's how we could potentially see an outbreak start.
Is that how dengue fever spreads?
That is the same way. In fact, the same mosquito. So dengue and chikungunya are very similar in those ways. They're two viruses. They're spread by the same mosquitoes. Again, not established here in Texas, but we have seen small outbreaks.
How is it that we don't have a malaria problem in the United States like so many other countries with at least tropical regions have?
Well, you know, we used to. And in fact, when we think about all the federal agencies are in D.C. or Maryland or Virginia, but the CDC, the U.S. federal public health agency is in Atlanta, and that's because there was malaria there back in the 1940s and 1950s. We did a really good job of eradicating the conditions that were needed for those mosquitoes to have malaria and to pass on the parasite. And we're seeing the same thing with some of these infections here. So one of the diseases that I mentioned briefly on DallasNews.com is a disease called murine typhus that spread to us from fleas that like to bite rats. And it used to be a big problem in Galveston, maybe like in the 1950s and up to the mid-1900s, we got rid of murine typhus in Galveston by getting rid of the rodent problem. But now it's starting to creep back again.
So good urban planning, good sort of community hygiene can be helpful.
All of those things play into it. Some of those things are trickier to deal with, like rising temperatures, really high poverty rates in some areas. But we've tackled some of these diseases before only to see them coming back again now.
What's leishmaniasis?
Leishmaniasis is a really interesting one. That's another parasite that is spread by sandflies and normally isn't fatal, especially when it causes the skin type of disease, but it causes really severe skin sores and skin boils, which can take up to a year to heal. Now, we used to see this in troops returning from the Middle East. And in fact, one of the nicknames for leishmaniasis is the Baghdad boil, because that's where these guys were becoming infected. But we've seen outbreaks of leishmaniasis now in Texas, including in North Texas and in Oklahoma as well. And the really frustrating thing about this is people become infected. They have these horrible, disfiguring skin sores over their body, sometimes even on their face. They go to the doctor and the doctor gives them antibiotics, gives them all the wrong treatments because they don't realize what disease they really have.
All right. And what's neurocysticercosis?
Oh, gosh, that's a really gruesome one. That is a disease where you have cysts of a larval pork tapeworm cause big fluid-filled sacs inside the brain. And it can cause seizures, it can cause nausea, headaches, vomiting, even comas. And to be treated, people will need to take a medicine, an antiparasitic disease, but they may also need really severe brain surgery to release some of the pressure in the brain and to pull out the cysts.
Goodness. Is this something that you know if you have, at least?
That one you would. I spoke to a woman in Houston who became infected a few years ago, and she had brain surgery actually earlier this year. A young woman with a really, really sad story. She probably became infected because she ate food prepared by somebody who had the infection who didn't wash their hands very well. Mm. And she's a young woman. She's in her 40s. It's completely changed her life. She had to have brain surgery. She's had to have a shunt that goes from her brain into her abdomen to keep releasing the fluid. And even now, 6 months after she had the medicines and the brain surgery, she's still having problems with her vision. She's dizzy and she's nauseous. And she wouldn't let me use her name because even though she poses no risk to anybody else at this point, she is so scared about the stigma of having an infection that people don't really understand what it is. And the same thing happened with Candace with Chagas disease. In fact, she said to her doctor, I have this infection. Oh my gosh, I got it in Texas. Shouldn't I tell my neighbors to look out for a kissing bug? And her doctor, I'm so horrified to think that another medical professional would say this. Her doctor said to her, do you know who Typhoid Mary was? Because if you want to tell people, that's what's going to happen to you. Hmm. Basically saying that she'd be ostracized, that people would think that she could spread the infection onto others. And she was trying to do the right thing by raising awareness. And her doctor totally freaked her out.
All right, well, let's finally get here to West Nile virus, which has become common enough that we don't necessarily think of this as being so exotic as we did maybe a few years ago when the first reports of cases started making headlines.
Yeah, West Nile virus. Texans, I mean, are intimately, sadly aware of West Nile virus. It's only been in the U.S. for about 15 years, though. So it's astonishing, isn't it, how it doesn't take a long time for these diseases to become established, to become normal here. But West Nile's a disease that has infected many, many thousands of people. And it's interesting that what we see is the tip of the iceberg, because about 80% of people who get infected with West Nile when they get bitten by a mosquito will have zero symptoms. And then about 20% will have what we call West Nile fever, which is milder, but still really, really horrible, you know, really painful disease. And then 1% or less will get the West Nile that affects their brain and the lining of their brain, really, really severe kind.
Hmm. All right. How do you stay sanguine knowing about all this and counseling people on what to do about diseases that sound really terrifying?
Yeah. So I moved to Dallas right before Ebola arrived in Dallas. So that's where a lot of people got to know me, because you will know that my approach to things like this is the opposite of fear mongering. It's just being aware. We live alongside animals and weird bugs. It's what makes this world so interesting. And we can't protect ourselves against everything all the time. But it's really important to be empowered through information, to know that these diseases are out there, for doctors out there to get up to date, to realize the epidemiology of these infections, and just to spread the word, and to be as just not overly cautious, but if you have wood piles outside the house, that's something you can do. Move them away from the home. You can use some common insecticides to kill bugs around the house, and look out for symptoms in your pets as well.
Dr. Seema Yasmin is professor of public health at the University of Texas at Dallas and staff writer at the Dallas Morning News. You can check out her interactive series on neglected tropical diseases in Texas at dallasnews.com. Seema, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for making time for us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.